what happened with Christianity and what happens every day in almost all ideologies, we institutionalize a concept and ideal for the way that a life should be lived.
Why would I protect any ideology when I haven't even protected the one that comes out with a belief system I now have? We cannot explain how everything exists. The truth is that what we know is that nothing comes from nothing.
We can actualize the supernatural in people's existence and lives.
I believe people can change, but I know it's a belief. But at the same time, the reason I would hold it as a truth is because I have changed.
You are listening to Mind Shift, a podcast by Aaron McManus and Earl McManus.
The podcast committed to blow your mind.
I was so excited about that intro. Happy New Year.
Oh, man, it's so exciting. 2024.
2024. Can you believe it?
It's already been a big month. It's amazing. We're just a few weeks into it, and it feels like so many things have already happened.
So many things have happened. Why am I tired already? This month just started. But you celebrated your 40th year anniversary of being married.
Yep, me and Kim. It takes two people to celebrate 40 years of marriage. We went to England, and we were going to go to London, but we went out to the Cotswolds and stayed out there for a week, and it was just amazing. And she's, you know, she's a farm girl, so she just loved being in the middle of all the rolling hills and farms and sheep and goats and horses and cows.
She loved it.
It was wonderful. It was freezing cold and raining all the time, and she was in her sweet spot. She just loves the rain. She loves the cold. And we had a great time together.
That's very exciting. Okay, so I don't even know where to start. We have so many things we could talk about. We have so many directions we could go. But I think first and foremost, I just want to thank everybody who's listening to this podcast and watching this podcast. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for being a part of this community and tribe and pod. And we are just so grateful for you. I'm going to ask you something, though, real quick. I'm just going to start this off strong. If you have not rated and reviewed this podcast, go do it. And if you haven't checked us out on YouTube, go to youtube.com. Nope, go to earlmcmanus.com/YouTube and hit subscribe. You can check this out. We're in black and white, but should we go to color this year? Should we? I'm looking at Austin.
I mean, we're dressed in black and white, so does it really matter?
It doesn't. I don't know.
We have a white backdrop and a black table.
Maybe we try.
What would change?
What would color? I don't know. Just reveal. That's what we do when I brought it up. Maybe we go in color. Oh.
Maybe every episode we just wait for that one like drop, that insight, that profound thought, and boom, we go color.
It goes in color. Okay. So we have a few different things we could talk about.
Yeah.
What would you like to talk about?
You know, so many things. And I think one of the things we did last year, and I love that we did, is we really focused on arenas where people could develop and grow and expand as human beings. And we kind of stayed away from what was like our pandemic era conversations about culture and politics and more social cultural issues. But it's almost impossible to avoid them sometimes, because once you're a social creature, once you're on social media, once you have a presence, you're always getting feedback, you're getting affirmation, you're getting critique, you're getting questions. And one of the things that really strikes me sometimes is that people ask you questions over and over again because they want to shift your conversation to their conversation. So I think you do have to be careful in life to not allow other people to set the agenda for your life, for your conversations. But on the flip side, our podcast is really a fun place to talk about a lot of things. It's also an important place. We can bring up different issues. But for me, a lot of times it happens is we can talk about an issue, but I'm really far more interested in the nuances behind the issue. And for instance, it has been we, it seems like you and me and several people on our team at Mosaic have been like all bombarded by one person in their DMs and focused on a very specific issue for him. And I thought I was the only one getting bombarded by him. But then I found out that you were as well, and Carlos is as well. And then he sent me a photograph of an interaction, I suppose it was with Carlos, where he was just absolutely just being disrespectful and judgmental and condemning. And that's when the first time I actually just responded to him, and that was very mild. But his whole issue was around the Israeli-Palestinian issue, which of course is incredibly volatile. And I'm saying this while my wife, your mom, is on her way to Israel, and she's going to be in the middle of that war zone. And, you know, she's going to be there for a week with sometimes six meetings a day. And so it's not that we're indifferent to this situation. And in fact, you know, in a very personal way, it's come home to us. It's inside of our house. It's a part of who we are. And yet his language every single time was, why don't you talk about the genocide in Palestine, the genocide in Palestine. And I thought it was interesting because I've seen a lot of people use this language. And you know, to begin with, the thousands upon thousands of people who have lost their lives, who have been killed during this conflict, it's just horrific. And it's almost as if you can get caught, depending on which side you're on, using language that's completely indifferent to the other side. And so, even before I talk specifically about his statement, any humane person has to care about people who are dying in Palestine and people who have, died in Israel. And that to me is a human issue. It's not about Jews and Arabs. It's not about, Israel and Palestine. It's just about humans. And just the images of the families, the women, the children who have lost their lives, and it's horrific. And I think sometimes we forget that war is a horrible thing. And so it's not even about the war that I have any pushback. It's the language of, why aren't you condemning the genocide? The moment someone chooses a word that has within it a worldview, it polarizes people who actually can embrace you in dealing with true injustice and suffering and finding a human solution. Because there have been genocides in human history, and there are genocides happening all over the world right now. And one of the things that strikes me is when someone says, why aren't you speaking out against this genocide? It's the very same person who doesn't even know about other genocides around the world. They're just completely unaware that there are genocides happening in Africa and genocides that are happening in the Armenian and Turkish world. There are genocides happening of Christians in Islamic nations. There are genocides of Muslims in China. And there are actual genocides that are taking place around the world and when you're using the legal and important definition of a genocide, that there's a strategic commitment to eliminate a people. That's a very specific crime, very specific evil. And in no way, even if you completely disagree with Israel in their intent, does this qualify as a genocide? It's a horrific war. It's a tragedy, and then maybe it's a disproportionate response. I'm not even saying it may not be. And when you have tens of thousands of people who will lose their lives, but it isn't for my limited understanding, when people think this is a retaliation, it's not. When people think, oh, this is an act of vengeance, it's not. What it is a very strategic engagement to eliminate Hamas. Now, you may agree or disagree, and you may completely disagree with the approach, and you may think that the bombing of the Palestinian area is completely unethical, immoral. I'm not even bringing that up. But the intent of Israel is not genocide. They're not trying to wipe out the Palestinian people. In fact, the Palestinian people have grown and flourished in terms of numbers dramatically over the past decades. And so I think it's really important when you're accusing someone of something and you're trying to get other people aligned with you. The moment he says to me, why aren't you speaking out against the genocide? I can't respond to that. And because the moment I go, I speak against it, it looks like I'm indifferent and uncaring and don't care about the people who are losing their lives in Palestine. And then the moment I agree with it, I'm actually saying that Israel is engaging in a genocide, which is not historically true, and it's not even functionally true. And it's just like saying that when we went to war against Germany, that we're committing a genocide against the German people, or we were committing a genocide against the Japanese people. When you go to war against someone, your intent might simply be peace or survival, or it might even be conquest, but it may not. But genocide is a very different thing. And so even without dealing with the political issue, and I'll let you jump in here, you know, I actually wanted to just jump back and go, we always need to ask ourselves, what is the worldview contained in our language, in our words? Because when we choose a certain word, and I think what happens is that people take catchphrases, they just take on words and phrases that has for them emotional value and meaning, and they don't even understand what they're saying. And so a lot of the slogans that people have been chanting, you know, whether it's from the river to the sea, that statement contains within it a commitment to the annihilation of Israel. And I do think this is, what's that phrase you used? It's not catfishing.
Gaslighting. Yes.
When you accuse the other people of doing what you're doing. Yeah, I think that is the perfect strategy here, because Hamas's stated intention is the elimination of Israel. I mean, their desired outcome would be a genocide, the complete elimination of the Jewish people in the Middle East. And so then you can go, oh, Israel's committing genocide. So then you ignore what the actual stated intention is. I don't think you can find anywhere in a official legal position where Israel's going, our commitment is to genocide of the Palestinians. But you can find that with Hamas, where their leaders have openly declared that. And I know this is controversial, but since someone has been asking me over and over and over again, I just thought I'd just share my perspective on this. And I think war is horrible. I don't know that this is the most, I don't think this is necessarily the only option that Israel had. I think Israel could have chosen other options. But I don't know. I'm not there. I don't understand the strategic nature of those decisions. I think the greater question that gets avoided is the real, to me, unimaginable evil is that Hamas has within their strategy using their own people as a weapon, a wall of defense against Israel. And you have a very significant dilemma when a particular culture or ideology doesn't have a value for the life of their own people and sees their death and sacrifice as something moral and noble. I don't think we even know how to talk about what's happening in the Middle East. See, I don't think the American mind understands the mental constructs of people who aren't Western. And that's, I think, a part of the dilemma that we're in. We're in a shift in military engagement. The Vietnam War was a shift in an approach toward war that we'd never seen before. By the way, the Revolutionary War was the same way. You know, the British would line up with their redcoats, and the America and the, you know, the what would become the Americans would be hiding behind trees and wearing brown so they couldn't see them. And there was a radical shift in the strategic strategy. Most of us couldn't conceptualize a strategic military strategy that says our best strategy is to build our military outposts underneath hospitals and schools because our enemy has a higher value for life, and so they won't bomb them than we do. I think we're living in an entirely new era of how war is engaged. And I think that's a very terrifying possibility.
I think it's really interesting to that we finally are sitting down to talk about this. And I think it's something that, you know, obviously happened on October 7th and
yeah.
we're now months past. And we were, it happened the second day of the Arena Conference.
Yeah.
And so it was a very sobering morning and something that was very heavy. And I remember I was up really late the 6th and then up really early the 7th. And I sent you a few different videos I found online saying like, is this real? Do you think this is real? Because there's so much misinformation and so much propaganda and just people on the internet being ridiculous. It's hard to know what to believe. But the videos kept coming and they kept coming and they kept coming. And then the invasion of the rave music festival that was happening
yeah.
in Israel happened. And then videos were pouring out online. And so I think as a Westerner, observing this entirely through social media, and I don't really pay attention to mainstream media because I think most of it is pretty unethical and propagandic, and so can social media, but I'd prefer to see it from people who are doing their best to post, you know, live in the moment versus, you know, being paid by XYZ. But it was a really interesting response, right? And then obviously having friends who are in the Jewish community and having friends who are Muslim as well, having healthy discourse, having reaching out to them going, what's going on? How do you feel about what's going on? How do I be there for you as a friend? And the I think the common denominator, maybe the theme throughout is the approach, mm-hmm. is how do we approach situations like this that are so obviously complicated, right? It's simple for me in one side that it was not Israel that was invading a music festival in Palestine, that it was Palestinians invading Israel and killing innocent people, women, children. And obviously the conversation quickly becomes much broader the moment you bring that up to anyone who is very sensitive about, and rightfully so, right? We have our right to feel how we feel in many different ways, but I think to be logical in these moments is really hard, but really important to get to that place, right? I think listening to the podcast with Lex Fridman and Jared Kushner was really interesting, no matter how you feel about Kushner's politics and his correlation to Trump being his son-in-law. He's a really educated, really well-spoken young man who I would much prefer that he would run for president, and I hope that he does. But having his perspective was really interesting, and also Friedman's perspective on the situation and what happened. I think they were filming a podcast and then actually went back and filmed a different part about what was going on. I think it was the week that everything was happening that they were filming. And for me, it's about the approach, right? It's understanding that all life really does matter. That on the Palestinian and Gaza Strip, it matters. The Israeli lives matter. The American lives, the international lives, the people who were kidnapped in that situation, they all matter. And so how to have a human perspective on something and how to approach the nuance of and distinction between two people groups or two different people groups who are going to war now, right? Because that's the reality, that there is a war and there is a response, because there is a response to what happened in at this music festival.
Yeah.
And these attacks. And the difference is, it really is how you defend yourself. And I don't think, to my knowledge, that Israel uses schools and temples and places where
civilians
and hospitals, places where civilians gather and are gathered to protect themselves. And then on the other side, you could say, how could this ever happen? That Gaza is one of the most monitored and secured facilities, places, you know, the term open air prison is used a lot. And those are and genocide is used a lot. And that's where it becomes very nuanced, right? It becomes very complicated because I can see both sides. I can see how you can feel this way, but to watch maybe to watch a lot of younger citizens in the US really rally for the Palestinian people, and not just that, but against Israel and Jewish people, is a complicated thing to see. I was in Stockholm, and I was in London in December, and one of the first things when I was in London that my Uber driver asked me is, "Are you Jewish?" And he was obviously Muslim. I mean, he had he had, you know, he had a flag. He had a Quran in the car. He was very gentlemanly, mm-hmm. but I thought that was a very inappropriate question to ask. It's one of the first things to ask is, are you Jewish? Because what if I was Jewish? What if I was Israeli? Would that change the way you treat me? Would that change where you take me? And I thought that was a very, it made me feel a deep sense of lack of safety for my friends, right? And then we had a great conversation because I said, no, I'm not, but the people that I love dearly are. And then I also have a lot of Muslim friends from Lebanon, from Syria, who are wonderful people. And so I quickly turned it to that and we had a great conversation. But then when I was in Stockholm, it was really interesting to see because my friends there were going, what's your perspective? My two friends are incredibly edgy and musical and artistic and wonderful people, but I think they would be seen as far more liberal in the conservative space than most people. And so when they asked me, they're like, no, everyone here is pretty pro-Palestine unless you're super conservative in the church. And then I went to the city centers and there were protests everywhere. You know, given it's Stockholm in negative 10 degrees, it wasn't quite the same, you know, mm-hmm. as it was on all of these campuses around the country in the US, but there was a palpable tension of circumstance. And how do we approach each other and approach the situation? And even talking about this young man who is DMing us on Instagram, and I don't know him, I can't speak to him really. I can say that the thing I spoke to him was, your approach sucks. It lacks tact. It lacks respect. It lacks any intuition and sense of humanity. You're already, and I said this to him, you're accusing Mosaic, which I'm not. And he said, you're the one non-pastor and that I approached and you've responded to me. And all I said was, no wonder no one's responding to you because your approach sucks. You're disrespectful. You're rude. You're accusatory. You're grouping us in the same space as genocidal, right? You're putting us under that definition and term, which I think is unfair because we didn't make a stance as Mosaic and I'm a part of that community. It's where I tithe. It's where I serve. It's my family, where I worked for a long time. And I was really proud of our community. You know, I have friends in the Armenian community who are frustrated with us that we didn't post about what was going on and with their people. And so I understand, I have friends in the Muslim community who are frustrated with us because we didn't post about Palestine. And I know that there's people inside of our community who are really, who are young and old, who feel the need to stand up for both sides and maybe differ from our perspective. And I really respect their opinions, though I don't necessarily agree. And so how do we approach the conversation with anyone, with everyone? Is there a right way to approach? Is there a wrong way to approach? Are there, you know, when I said, I told this young man, like, you're being incredibly disrespectful and I refuse to have a conversation with you. And I said, one, I'm not paid to talk to you. You don't follow me. You're not my friend. And this is social media. Like, I don't owe you anything. And I think that's a good thing to remember.
Yeah, I love that.
Right? And the other thing was, I said, those are my pastors. So go to them and apologize, and then I'll have a conversation with you. Mm-hmm. Given that's on him to decide, not on me. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to sit at a table of people who are disrespectful.
And the irony is that I did take enough time to go to his Instagram, and he wasn't talking about anything meaningful.
And he definitely wasn't talking about Palestine.
No.
Which I thought was really interesting and ironic.
There's an odd thing where everyone wants you to be what they're not. But there's also like this, it is a peculiar thing that if you can hold other people in judgment for, quote, how they're not living up to your expectations, you don't have to look in the mirror and deal with who you are and what you're not accomplishing in your life. And when I look at it, just back to this issue, there's so many big issues in the world. So many, I mean, frankly, the abuse and murder of the Muslims in China on a human level is one of the greatest atrocities happening right now. I mean, there's such abuse in India and genocides that happen in that part of the world. And like, you could spend every day of your life focusing on a particular humanitarian issue or issue of injustice around the world. And if that's what your particular calling and passion is, then you do that.
No. Don't let them settle.
No. I mean, there are people who's journalists who travel the world,
yeah,
highlighting, social ills and crises and I'm glad they're out there.
But are they really journalists or are they spawn of propaganda?
No, I mean, there are people who do. I believe there are people who really.
Do you have media sources that you actually truly trust?
I trust Sasha when he flies to Ukraine.
He doesn't watch any of those.
No, he doesn't. But he's one of those journalists. He'll go and take photographs.
But you have an incredible network of people, and I think that's a great gift of being a part of the church. How do you know who to trust and who to listen to? Because I rarely, because I'm someone who has, for whatever reason, I find myself very unimportant, but has caused people to get very upset with online, and people really choose to, have come at me in the past. And, it's why I was private on social media for a long time, why I wanted to delete it. And if I had it my way, I would never have it. I would love to get married, have kids, and disappear off the internet, and preferably off the face of the earth. I like my island. In my dreams, I go to my island in my mind. But how do you know who to follow?
Well, first of all, I want to be clear, even with our podcast, we should not be your principal source of news.
No, we're commentary.
We're commenting on life, right?
Yes.
And if you expect that we're going to cover every issue that you think is important to you, that's just not going to happen here. Basically, we cover what's important to us.
And we also, we cover what we think should be in the conversation.
Yeah, we do. We curate what conversations we think need to be had right now.
Right.
And where we can make a positive contribution. So the reason I brought up this one is because I do think I can make a positive contribution. I do think you can make a positive contribution to this one. And in that—
So back to the question, how do you know who to listen to?
You don't.
Okay, so how do you do your best to know?
You use multiple sources. I think that's what I do. What I do is multiple sources that have different perspectives, and I know they have different perspectives. I think more important than who do you trust is, do you know their perspective? And once you know their perspective, you can trust their perspective and go, okay, they're always going to have a more liberal bent on things. They're always going to have a more conservative bent on things. They're always going to, they see the world through victim and victimizer. And so that's how the narrative comes out. And by the way, it's a huge part of it. That a lot of what's happening in news media and in cultural politics is that everything is about a victim and a victimizer. So there's someone who's in power and someone who's powerless. There's someone who's at fault and someone who's not. And so what happened instantly, historically, Israel has always been seen as the victim.
Yes.
And so no matter what stories you told, they were always in the right because they were the victim. That may not have always been true, but that was the way the story was. Now they're the victimizer. And so no matter what they do, they're wrong. And Palestine is seen as the victim. So it's amazing to me. They can kill people at a music festival. They can slaughter and rape and decapitate people. They can kill children. And it's almost completely justified because they're the victims. And so you have to be careful. The moment a framework neutralizes evil for one party and accentuates it for the other, because then you realize, you're not hearing news. Everything is being filtered to facilitate the belief and the confirmation of that view. And so the moment you go, wait a minute, why is there more concern here than here? Or why isn't there a conversation here and here? It's because that framework doesn't allow the opposite.
Okay, because then it brings something up.
Yeah.
So then, obviously that's our knowledge of that moment that happened at the music festival and kind of the moments after.
Yeah.
It's very personal to me because people that are and were very close to me were directly affected by this. My good friend's cousin's wife was at that music festival and they found her car at the Gaza border and they haven't found her, and who knows where she may be. And for me, it's personal, right, in that way. And there's so many stories like that of friends who have relatives who live in Israel who are going through something similar. Obviously, there's, I imagine, millions of stories like that or thousands of stories like that on the other side, right? And so then you have videos after video of, whether it may be Israeli soldiers hurting young kids in the Gaza Strip. And then they have that ammunition to go against what you just said. So it becomes this like dog pile of atrocities, you know, and loss of human life or human brutality. And is there ever, it just feels like everything is always escalated. Is there a way to de-escalate and actually approach the situation in a healthy human way?
Yeah, I think it does become difficult because you might have a right side with bad agents. Yeah, and so it's undeniable that even when, let's say, the U.S. went into certain wars for a very good end, like to stop Hitler, you know, to stop the Japanese slaughter of the Chinese, and those were engagements with a good intention, but it doesn't mean that all the soldiers that we sent didn't do some evil stuff. So then you end up with even U.S. soldiers doing things that we would never condone. And so it's easy to find the exception to the rule. So what you have to do is you have to step back and go, like, what is the rule? Like, you know, if I just listen to them without propaganda, what are they saying? You know, and so this is like why for me, I have very particular views about the Middle East is that, you know, without any propaganda from Israel, I listened to Hamas, and I've been to the Middle East many times, and I have been in engagements with Hamas and other people in that world.
The Taliban, the Hezbollah.
And I do know that their principal intention is the elimination of Israel. And when you look at Islam as a whole, I mean, this is from 40 years of study. This is not from this situation. That the nuances is like the word Islam comes from the word submit, that can also be nuanced to be translated peace. And the reason is because for the Islamic mind, you have peace when you submit. And so if you can get the whole world to submit to Allah, you'll have a world of peace. But in that same mindset, it is acceptable to eliminate the infidel. And so if you just look at it pragmatically. When I was young, and you know, I was probably heavily influenced by socialism, and one of the things that actually shifted me was I just didn't see people running to North Korea, but I saw them running to South Korea. I didn't see people running to Russia from the United States, but running from Russia back then to the United States. I didn't see people running from New York to Beijing. Saw people escaping from Beijing to New York. So I got to look and go, just from a cosmological perspective.
Or just human migration.
Yeah, you're going, this political system doesn't work because people don't want to be there. If you have to force people to stay and keep them from leaving, you don't have a healthy system. And when I look at Islam, wherever Islam takes over the world, free will is lost. You do not have freedom. You do not have freedom of religion, freedom of choice. You have legalism, you have Sharia law, and you have a loss of humanity, not the engagement or the elevation of humanity. So I just look at it, even if I didn't believe in any religion, I would go, that's not for me. And we have to evaluate things and go, what does it look like when it actually has power? And that's, I think, is an important question you have to ask yourself. And as imperfect, and that's the problem, is that everyone who lives here can go, capitalism is imperfect, democracy is imperfect. Of course it is, because humanity is imperfect. There will never be a perfect system. But you need to be careful and look at all the world systems and go, well, what alternative are you actually trying to replace this with? And for all of its weaknesses, I think democracy is the best human choice for how to run a society. And so I look at it and go, I do know what Israel will look like if Palestine takes over. And it will look like Palestine. And you just have to be aware of the fact that you're...
What do you mean by that? You mean it's going to look like a hot mess?
Well, there will be no more Jewish people there. There'll be no Christians there. Everyone will be Muslim.
Yeah.
And you know, so when everybody talks about, you know, Israel, it doesn't have a democracy, or Israel doesn't allow other people, I'm going, this isn't true.
There are free Palestinians who live in Israel and live good lives, but there are no free Jews that live in Palestine and live good lives.
Right, but look at Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq and you know, and Yemen, and begin to realize cultural philosophies, political ideologies create certain cultures. And ask yourself, is this the culture you want to accelerate and allow to expand across the world? And, you know, the Constitution, not a perfect document. I prefer it to Sharia law. And for me, it's like very simple.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe just I'm a simple person in that regard.
No, I think you're a very complex person that looks for the inception of the idea and the crux of the foundation of the principle.
Yeah.
I have a couple questions for you.
Yeah.
So what do we do with it, right? Because I think so many things are, as we're coming into like an election year as well, in the US, it's a really important thing. It's a really big thing. And you know, we obviously had the reality that, you know, Donald Trump, former president Donald Trump, won the Iowa caucus last night, which was might have been a big surprise, but maybe not so surprising in that our current president is lackluster in his approach and maybe presence in the media. And so it does feel like one of the greater nations in the world, or maybe more influential nations in the world, has kind of lost its identity a little bit, because it feels like there's this massive uproar within the younger communities and maybe the more liberal communities that, you know, we've become, which I find really ironic. And sorry to go into a tangent, because I was going to ask you a question. When you talk about Sharia law, you talk about like the beliefs, the core belief systems of Islam. You cannot be gay and be a Muslim.
No.
In a Muslim country.
No, you'll be killed.
You'll be killed. And in most situations, in even Western cultures, if your family is Muslim, you'll be exiled, right? And thrown away. And so it is interesting to me that a generation that cares so much about human rights and the LGBTQ communities are so supportive of a people group that would kill them and not let them have a voice. And so we talk about the, you know, the Second Amendment is the right to bear arms, but I think one of the most dangerous arms is our voice, right? Because I think the younger generation uses that as violently as you know, other generations have used ammo and guns and bullets. So how is it that we approach such a sensitive topic in such a divisive time, and how important is it for us to have a unified stance in these things? Or is it more important that we are able to speak freely and, you know, attack who we attack or allow the Sean Kings of the world to really, you know, thrive?
Well, I have to tell you, I felt like I had to learn yoga over the last six decades.
Okay.
Because growing up, it was the liberals, which I was one of them. We were the ones that were about freedom of thought. We were definitely freedom of speech, but we were way more freedom of thought. And we looked at all you conservatives as the ones who refuse to think. You're afraid of ideas. You're afraid of the truth. You wanted to shut down any conversation. You wanted a militant society. And somewhere along the way, I mean, I think I went to sleep on a Tuesday, woke up on a Wednesday, and the world turned upside down. Well, and all of a sudden,
it's only if the Wednesday identifies as a Wednesday.
Yeah, that is my point. That on Wednesday, I woke up and suddenly the conservatives were the ones who wanted debate. They're the ones who wanted freedom of thought. They're the ones who wanted the right to express their positions and views and go into the arena of ideas and fight about who's right. And it's the liberals that I was one, and I didn't stop being liberal. They stopped being
liberal.
Yeah. And they became totalitarian.
It's interesting.
And suddenly now you have to agree with everything that's said, and not just what's said, but how it's applied. And then you take the whole package. It's like liberals took on amendments, where if you're a liberal, you have to also agree with this. You also believe in this. You have to believe in this. You also have to believe in this. And it just all got attached. It's just the same way that a lot of conservative politicians knew if they were pro-life, they would get all the pro-life votes, even if all their other policies were terrible. And so it's like conservatives would just close their eyes and vote for whoever is pro-life, even if they would destroy the economy or didn't have a concern for the poor or whatever other issues. They just ignored the issues. And now it seems that on the left, it's, well, if you are completely committed to the redesign, the reengineering of society, where there is no longer a gender and there's, language is defined by who we say we are rather than what is. There is now, it's like that becomes the pro-life movement on the left side. And you go, wait a minute. I was a liberal because I believed in free thought and free speech. And I believed in governments not controlling my morality or my actions. I actually believe that. I believe government should not tell me what to do. And that government should not try to control my behavior. The government should not be in charge of moralizing Americans.
So is that just like an instance of power and the activation of power, that whenever side ends up achieving power, that they do become the supreme ruler of that ideology or implementing that ideology among society?
Yeah, that's the Achilles heel, is that once you're elected, you think you have the power to force everyone to do, say, and believe what you tell them to do, say, and believe, rather than saying, I now have power and I'm going to create space for everyone to have a conversation. It's like, no, now you have to believe what I believe. You have to do it the way I do it. And it's crazy. Even this conversation here, if we were pro-Palestine in everything we said and acted like Israel was committed to a genocide and, you know, and took all that language that has been given to us culturally, we would be loved by the left. And
no, we'd still be hated because we're both, because you're in a heterosexual relationship and I'm single and heterosexual, and they would still find a way.
if you didn't agree with everything, they would go to the next thing.
Yes.
And say, yeah, but you got to agree with this here.
And you got to agree with the next thing.
And then when the moment you agree there, you go, no, but you got to go here.
Yeah.
And so it never ends. And I think the difference is that we're at a place right now where the left and the right are not even having a conversation with each other anymore. They're just in their own little rooms and debating. And so it gets confusing because the right thinks that the most liberal person in the room is the liberal conservative. And the left thinks the most conservative person in the room is the conservative liberal. They're not realizing that there's a lot of mom and dads in Michigan and Iowa, in Illinois, in Kentucky, who are just trying to figure out really simple things in life, like how do I raise healthy kids, and that are not struggling with their identity and not struggling with being suicidal and depressed, and how do I pay the bills and have a job and have a career. And, you know, they're just dealing with everyday issues. And here we are.
Just good people trying to figure life out.
I never imagined a day where the dominant conversations in American culture was, are there really two sexes?
It feels, if you're being completely honest with yourself, and I think a lot of people in our current state of society have a really hard time with being honest with themselves. I think we have, for the first time in a long time, a subjective view of what is objective, right?
Absolutely.
Because I would say that I'm very pro-Palestinian people. I'm very anti-Hamas. I care about life. I care about life more than I think Hamas cares about their own people, right? And I think I care about people's freedom of speech more than I think the left cares about identity. And you can tell, and this is something that you've taught me, but when people institutionalize specific belief systems, someone asked me the other day, what's your least favorite religion? I said, Christianity. And they said, who's your favorite figure in religion? I said, Jesus. Right? Because I think what happened with Christianity and what happens every day in almost all ideologies, we institutionalize a concept, an ideal, for the way that a life should be lived, mm-hmm. for the embetterment of humanity. But the reality is that when we start institutionalizing those things, I think that on the right as well, when you become pro-life versus pro-choice and you become dogmatic about anything, you lose the human conversation. You end up losing the human.
Yeah.
And so how do we do it? Because it feels like our approach is suffering.
I've spent my adult life ripping Christianity to shreds for everywhere it's hypocritical.
Yeah.
And misrepresents who Jesus is. So why would I pretend that Islam is awesome? Why would I pretend that socialism works? Why would I protect any ideology when I haven't even protected the one that comes out with the belief system I now have? You know, and when I became a follower of Jesus, I never felt any moral obligation to pretend Christianity works or that it was an adequate or authentic expression of who Jesus was. In fact, I felt I needed to be more ruthless about anything related to what I believe than something I don't believe in. But at the same time, I think that we have to become clear thinkers. I was talking to your mom the other day, and I said, belief can become the enemy of truth. She goes, what do you mean by that? And I said, when you believe something with like every fiber of your being, you're incapable of discerning whether it's actually true or not. And that's why belief can be the enemy of truth.
Is that why love is so dangerous?
It is. And truth can be the enemy of belief. There's a moment a truth comes and it violates your belief. You reject that truth or you go to war against it. You know, to me, it's just it's the same thing as when I hear scientists who are in the world of biology or quantum mechanics or physics, and they come out and go, there's no God. And, you know, even with, you know, Stephen Hawking and, you know, saying because the law of gravity exists, we don't need a God. It's like, when you get to that point, you go, oh, you've just betrayed yourself. Because, you know, one, when nothing exists, there is no gravity. And there is no law of gravity. And you cannot have a law without a lawmaker. And what you realize is, oh, here's a person who came to the end of himself, seeing the complexity and the impossibility of explaining the universe, and you conclude there's no God. And I realize, and then everybody goes, you see, that's science. They're going, no, that's not science. That's desperation. That's a science. That's a scientist at the end of his life, tapping out of science and saying, I'm just going to leap here and say that everything came out of nothing. Like, look. I'm okay with the person saying, I just don't believe in God. I don't see any practical evidence for my life. I can accept that. But when a person goes, I've studied science thoroughly and there's no proof that there's a God, you're just lying to yourself. Your belief has gotten in the way of truth. Because the truth is we cannot explain how everything exists. That's the truth. The truth is that what we know is that nothing comes from nothing. That's the truth. But then the truth is everything seemed to have come from nothing. You know, and over here's your belief. Your belief can be, I don't believe there's a God. I think that somehow magic happened, that nothing created something. But then you have to try to scientifically explain that magic. And your belief can be, I believe there's a God. But you have to also realize you were not present. You know, when the nothing became something. And so you're making an intuitive leap. And I think it's helpful in life. And what I think I try to do and where I live in this tension is I live in the tension of belief and truth. I know that there's a difference between my beliefs and what is true.
Is there a truth that you were wrestling with that challenges your beliefs?
Yeah, and there are a few of them. I'm trying to figure out how to word them well. One of them is, how do people really change?
How or can?
No, I believe people can change. You see, that's a belief that may not be rooted in truth.
Okay.
But I'm holding on
that's
to that
belief. That's a great distinction.
Yeah. See, some people believe people can't change. I believe people can change, but I know it's a belief. But at the same time, the reason I would hold it as a truth is because I have changed. And since I don't think I'm the singular exception in the universe, since I can change, I think other people can change. But at the same time, how people change is for me a quandary. Like when I think about the part of me that's faith, you know, informed so dramatically, from the moment I came to faith in Jesus was like people changed by this. They changed by reading the Bible every day. They changed by praying. They changed by going to church. They changed by, you know, having these spiritual disciplines. And then 40 years later, I see a lot of people didn't change. But they did become more dogmatic, but they didn't change. And so I go, okay, I think that those things don't stop change, but they don't necessarily guarantee change. And then I look at other aspects of life where I see some people change in a purely like secular environment. Person weighed 300 pounds, now is 185 pounds of steely muscle, right?
Goggins,
yeah,
right?
That's what I'm thinking about, guys. And he clearly has changed and in many areas of his life. And
I would love to interview Goggins.
Yeah, I think that would be pretty, pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
So I'm a very, it's like, I feel like I live in two universes. One is the universe of ideas, one's the universe of practicality. And in my universe of practicality, I go, how do people change? How did I change? How do I help people change?
How do you think you changed?
Know? What?
How do you think you changed?
See, I think all my changes came in my internal world first, and then they were externalized.
Was it a saying, a repetition, a belief system? Because I don't know, because I always struggle with the phrase, well, God changed him. I'm like, well, not no, but not yes. He had to change.
Yes. And that's right. Not no, but not yes. That's a part of right? the dynamic like, of it.
Yeah.
It's the pro baseball player we met this past week who's wonderful.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I had a great 10-year career. He goes, well, you know, God had to go. No, I said, no, God did not play baseball. You played baseball. He goes, yeah, but you know, but I want to give God all the honor for everything I've done. So that's great. But you played baseball. And I think sometimes we have almost like this, you know, weird relationship with life, right?
It's a spiritual OCD.
Yeah. And I look at it and go, there are a lot of things that did change, but it seemed like the first thing that had to change is like almost like my self-belief.
Hmm.
Like where I feel like even like where Jesus changed me is changing my mind about myself.
Hmm.
Changing my mind about feeling worthless or being worthless. Changing my mind about not having talent. Changing my mind about being insignificant. Changing my mind about not being able to make a difference in the world. And I feel like a lot of the early, I guess if
no,
if
I finish that statement, a lot of the early what?
A lot of the early change in my life that happened in my spiritual journey was, I'm going to say it the way I experienced it, was Jesus changing me so that I could change my life.
Hmm.
See, I think a lot of us miss the triangle. We go, Jesus changes your life. And I go, no. Jesus changes you so you can change your life. But even there, it's like, I don't think Jesus can change you if you don't want to change. So there's still like this aspect of agency. The more I took personal responsibility for my life, the more powerful I became.
See, I think that's the change. I think God gives you the ability to take personal responsibility of your life. And every day we absolve that responsibility, we lose. And every day that we own that responsibility, whether we fail or succeed, we win.
Yeah, I agree. And this is a part of the tension where it's, oh, so if I take responsibility for my life, I grow. It sounds like you're not giving God ownership of your life. But ironically, it's like the more I gave God ownership of my life, the more I took responsibility for my life. It's like a magic trick.
Like, something came out of nothing.
Yeah.
And nothing
like,
came out of something.
It's like, Jesus, I'm giving you my life. And then it's like, oh, wow, I feel the weight of my life just been handed back to me. Now, Erwin, you got to live it. And, you know, and so I do sense, and I've always felt that I have access to the power of God in my life. I feel I have the source of the creator of the universe that dwells within me. And that confidence is, I think, the defining characteristic in how I live my life. Because the moment I start moving to my default mode of, I don't know if I can do this, or I don't know if I can get through this, all of a sudden, it's almost like these booster engines kick off inside of me going, yeah, that's why you're not doing this thing alone.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I feel like I become unstoppable. I've thought many times over the years, I don't know how a person gets through depression or like just when or sorrow or loneliness without Jesus, because it's so hard with him.
Yeah.
you know.
No, it is. And I don't know how. I think people.
Yeah.
I think people.
Yeah. And I think that's where God shows up, is through people.
I think so.
Yeah.
We talk about that a lot, about how you are the miracle in other people's lives.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Right?
We talk about that a lot. And, mm-hmm. and that, I think once you own that, you can be a miracle. You know, I was talking about this, and I hope these boys don't mind me sharing this, but I flew to Stockholm and surprised a friend for his 30th birthday, which is very random. Why go to Stockholm for 30th birthday? But I just felt like I needed to say yes to things. And I also felt like there's been a lot of doors opened and in my life that I haven't stepped through. And so this was like an invitation. And when I was invited, I wanted, I think my friends who, I was invited, so I wanted to go. And my friends in LA were like, you don't even show up to our birthdays, but I got to Stockholm for a birthday. But I don't know why, but there's a reason I needed to go. And so I went. And we were sitting at this lunch. They came over to where I was staying, and it was the four of us, and this idea of miracles came up. And both of these guys believe in God, and I think they have unique relationships with God. One of them who would be on the outside, the one who you'd think would believe in miracles, is, I don't believe in miracles. He is one of my favorite worship leaders in the world. I think he's more talented than anyone. He's phenomenal, and he loves his wife, and he has all these beautiful kids, and he talks about, he goes, I want to believe in miracles, but I've never seen one. And he grew up with a Pentecostal preacher father who was prophesying over people, who knew things about other people they did not know themselves. So he's going, I've seen things, but I don't believe in miracles. And the one you would think doesn't believe in miracles, just because he's tatted and edgy and cool and he has a heart of gold. But he would be the more cynical one. I think in that way we would connect. And he started crying. And he just says, I do. And he goes to tell the story. And it was really beautiful. And I think it was awkward and beautiful, because I think it should be more normalized for men to share deep things about themselves. But he says, I do. And we were like, well, why? And he goes, because I had a friend, and he's a bizarre friend. He's one of my friends from childhood, and he struggles with mental health, and he's all these things, addict or XYZ, and got sober, and calls him one day, and he goes, and I pick up the phone, and he goes, I'm going to kill myself. I have a gun right here. I'm going to kill myself. And he goes, okay. And the way he says it is so Swedish. It's so calm. The way he tells the story. And he says, okay, well, can I pray for you? And the friend says, sure, it doesn't matter though, because I'm going to kill myself right after. And he goes, okay, well, he prays for him. And then they hang up the phone, and he says, a few days later, he gets a call. He says, and this is the loophole in the story. I said, you didn't check in on him later? he says, no, he said he was going to kill himself.
That's Swedish too.
I don't know. This is where it was so Swedish. There was a lot of gaps. And he says, no, but he called me a few days later, and he says, can we meet for coffee? I didn't kill myself. And he goes, well, or you wouldn't be calling me. And he's just started crying, and he took a photo of, he's a brilliant photographer, and took a photo of him that day, and sitting kind of in the middle of the forest. And he started crying, and he said, I believe in miracles, because I believe that prayer worked. That prayer was a miracle. That for some reason, somehow, I don't think it was the quality of my prayer. I just think God moved in this person's life and kept him alive.
Wow.
And it was just such a beautiful realization that we can be that. We can actualize the supernatural in people's existence and lives.
Mm, I love that. You know, when I was divided between belief and truth,
yes.
When it comes to miracles,
yes.
I believe in miracles, but when it comes to truth, I'm convinced in the phenomenon of miracles, because regardless of what I believe, I've experienced the unexplainable. And I've had too many of them to discount them. I would have to be dishonest with what I've experienced to say the phenomenon of miracles does not exist. Because I have prayed, and supernatural things happened, things outside of nature, things that couldn't have been projected, things that couldn't have been planned or orchestrated by people. And so I absolutely do believe in miracles, and both as a belief in the truth. And I actually think that even people who don't believe in God depend on the phenomenon of miracle for success.
Hmm.
And that's why they call it luck. The phenomenon of miracle is what people call luck, is when something good happens your way that you cannot explain, that you'd had no control over. I think that's God just breathing into our lives, letting us know, I'm here, will you pay attention?
I love it. I think we're going to wrap this episode.
All right.
I think on that note, so thank you guys for listening to Mind Shift, a podcast with Aaron McManus and Earl McManus. And if you're listening to this podcast, we want you to rate and review this podcast. If you haven't, go to Apple Music or Apple Podcasts, go to Spotify, YouTube, wherever you're listening, rate and review it. It helps people find it. It would be really helpful for us, but you can also subscribe on YouTube, leave us a comment. You can also follow us on Instagram, our personals, but also our Mind Shift Pod Instagram. Follow, check out the clips that we post each week. Join us in sharing those clips and letting us know you are out there. We love you guys. And for all of our arena community people, we're grateful. We cannot wait to see you guys in October. Oh, and we have Mosaic Conference, March 1st and 2nd.
That's right. Come right here in Los Angeles, here in Hollywood.
Yes. I'm going to give people on this podcast the same discount code that we gave the people on the arena because—
You are?
Yeah.
Are you? That's it. You're stealing.
I'm giving. If you're listening to this and you want to come and join us at Mosaic Conference, which is the community that you lead and that I get to be a part of, March 1st and 2nd, and I think the night before is a worship night. So really, it's the 30th, the 1st and the 2nd. February 29th. Wow. Oh, it's a leap year.
We're going to leap into the conference.
The 29th Ooh. Of February, March 1st and 2nd.
So how do they get the discount code?
Austin's going to link it in the bio of this episode.
Okay.
And then it's going to be a Brushfire link and you can put in arena and it's going to give you a discount code. Right now, I think it's $250 is what it actually costs. With the discount code, it's $149 because I bamboozled Elisa and she approved it. So join us at conference. I know the crew would be excited to see you guys. We'll see you guys
March 1st and 2nd.
Second.
All right. Have a great week, guys.
You too.